So if you listen to the beginning of each broadcast of this three-hour show, I say something to this effect. Hi, welcome to Unreal Bluegrass. I'm Steve Martin, your host for 3 hours of the best bluegrass across the generations, combining conversation with the legends and those becoming. My guest today, Paul Brewster, firmly in the legend category, without a doubt. I was very happy to be able to reach Paul for this show because I wanted to feature, I've played it many times, but I want to feature again this incredible tune that Daniel Grindstaff has put together. It was Daniel's idea. He got Paul Brewster to sing the lead, and Paul got Dolly Parton to join in. That's not bad. Forever Young, which is a Rod Stewart tune, I think. Only Rod Stewart tune. I think other people have done it, but in my mind, it was originally a Rod Stewart. So there you go. Bluegrass borrows from all kinds of music. Art borrows from art. And we'll start off this segment with that tune, which is number one everywhere, Forever Young, with Paul Brewster, my guest, and Dolly Parton. And then we're going to talk to Paul Brewster about an absolutely remarkable career that that man's had and continues to have. To the audience of Unreal Bluegrass, you just heard a song that is quickly becoming one of my favorites. The tune is Forever Young, and I'm very happy to have, for the first time on Unreal Bluegrass, Paul Brewster. Paul, how are you doing?
Doing good, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing fine, doing fine. This new song, Forever Young, with you and Dolly Parton, we're going to talk about how that came to be. And I'm just telling you, when I first played it, yeah, it's great to have Dolly Parton on there, but your vocal on this is absolutely numbing. I mean, it's just fantastic. And it's number one right now. There must be a reason for it, huh?
Well, I guess there is. I don't know how to answer that, but it's good to see, yeah.
It's doing really well.
I've
talked to Daniel about it, and I thought, man, I need to talk to Paul. I've known who Paul Brewster was forever and ever, and so much history involved in what you're doing, and we've actually crossed paths once at a, I'm certain, Paul, we talked about this off the air, it was a birthday lunch for Sonny. A big one. There was a big crowd in the back room there in Hendersonville, and I'm certain that I met you.
Right.
So Forever Young, we're going to get into that in a little bit, but you have a long history, a very, very, illustrious history in the bluegrass field.
Yeah, I've been in it since about 1975.
Yeah, and you've played with the best of the best. I mean, you were with.
I have, that's for sure.
Tell me a little bit about some of them and what you remember where you started. I know you played with Ricky Skaggs. I know the Osborne brothers, and you've done just about everything. But tell me a little bit about your stint with whichever one of those comes to mind first.
Well, I started in Knoxville. Where I live now, too, by the way. But I started with a group called Knoxville Grass.
Was that Phil Ledbetter?
No. Phil was a little younger than me.
Okay.
And he had another band that he played in at the time a little bit. But I started playing with them about 1975, 76, in there.
Tell me about then what Knoxville Grass, if you remember the makeup and how they got started, just a little bit about that.
Well, they had formed before I got with them, but my stint started really with the banjo player. I knew the banjo player. He was from Maryville. Jimmy Millsaps was his name, and I started playing. He'd come by the house and play a little bit, and he was the man. Him and Glenn Laney started Knoxville Grass.
Okay.
And I started playing with him, playing guitar and singing with him, and he invited me to come down. They were opening up a brand new Burger King on Magnolia Avenue.
That's big doings.
So big doings. And I happened to go down there, and they let me sit in and sing, and that's kind of where it started. From that point on, of course, we got together more, and it just ended up that I was part of the band in 75, and we recorded 3 albums. We just together for 3 years. And it seemed like 20 when you're a kid. We did 3 albums together. And where that all started. Of course, we played around the UT area. That was big, around the young kids in the university area. And a lot of frat parties and so forth and so on, that kind of thing, which everybody does when they start.
Sure.
And we played at a place called Buddy's Barbecue. We kind of started that, and Buddy built on, added on to his barbecue place there, and Buddy Smothers, and that was where it started. Of course, Buddy's got a lot of barbecue now around Knoxville. area and a couple other places too. But anyway, that was the first one, and on Kingston Pike. And my uncle Bud Brewster ran Pick and Grin Music Store right next door, and had Buddy built. He built a stage and built an extra big room for people to come in and get barbecue and eat before we played. We'd come in and play. And that's kind of where Buddy's Barbecue got its start, as far as putting different bands in, stuff that people we knew, like Country Gentlemen, J.D. Crow, and Ricky Skaggs. And
that's where I wanted.
Ricky had Boone Creek at the time.
Yeah, they were great. That was a great
band. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. They were great.
Sounds like the place where I would want to eat barbecue.
Well, it was great barbecue. Still is. And that's where all that started. And we had lines started way before we started playing. They'd come in and eat. And a lot of young kids from right down the street, UT. And that's where that started. And we brought a lot of different acts in. And that's just and it got going. You know, that really, it was when bluegrass kind of started as far as the new sound.
Well,
you know,
yeah.
Everybody wanted to get away, a little bit away from the upright bass and go to electric bass, and even Ricky did that with Boone Creek. Everybody was starting to use electric bass to get away from that old sound.
Yeah.
And then of course that turned back around. Everybody wanted stand up bass after, you know, back in the '80s, late '80s, everything goes around in a circle, you know.
They went from the bass players having a break on their left hand to where they had to tear up their fingers and right hand again just to
right.
play those songs.
Oh yeah, they had to play some kind of a break on it. Yeah.
Let me ask you this then. That's a great start. So you had an interest in bluegrass. You just didn't show up and start singing. You had an interest in bluegrass before Knoxville Grass, right?
Well, yeah, I did. My dad played.
Okay.
My dad played with the Kaz Walker. If you're familiar with Kaz.
Okay.
Back in the, he started with that with Kaz Walker way back in the, I think it was in the 40s.
Okay.
That's when he went to work with Kaz Walker, him and my Uncle Ray.
Okay.
Before he got killed in 1948. But they worked with Kaz Walker for many years, my dad did. And he retired in 1964. And got out of the business.
So they exposed you to bluegrass. What was the bluegrass music that they played? Obviously timely to them, but what was it that caught you about bluegrass besides being around it?
Well, stuff that he did. They did a tune called Mawkin Banjo.
Oh yeah,
it was kind of like banjo and mandolin.
Yeah, it's kind of like. If correct me if I'm wrong. It's kind of like. Feud and banjos a little bit.
That's where they got the idea from.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
That was two banjos. That wasn't a banjo and a mandolin.
Right, right.
And Dad and them made a song called Mawkin Banjo in 1956, the year I was born.
Mm.
And they recorded it and had a good record on it, actually. And that's where Deliverance came from. That's where the guys that played, Eric Weisberg and... I can't remember the other guy.
Steve Manning?
Yeah, I can't remember. But that's kind of where they got theirs. They got Mawkin Banjo from the Dillards, and Dillards got it from my dad and my uncle.
Oh, my God, okay.
You see, so it just kind of morphed that way.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And we were watching TV one night, and when I was a kid, and saw the advertisement for the movie Deliverance. Of course, they played that theme song. And my dad was asleep on the couch, and he turned around and said, "That's our theme song." And I said, "Oh, really? Great. That's good." Anyway,
you just open the door and let all the money and the residuals come in.
No, it didn't work like that. But that's another story.
That's another story.
Arthur Smith wrote the song.
I know.
Don Reno, but they did it with two banjos, and it was a little different than what my dad did.
There's a long story. I've had Eric Weisberg on the show, and we've talked about how...
I think they got that from the Dillards, if I'm not mistaken.
Well,
I might be wrong about that, but I'm pretty sure the Dillards did it first. Well, I mean, after my dad and my uncle did it, and then the Dillards did it, and Eric Weisberg, I think they must have got it from them.
They could have. I'd have to go back and listen. That was several years ago. But they
yeah.
So, all right. So you're brought up and you're around bluegrass for that reason. Are you are you interested in the singing part or the playing? What did you play?
Both. Okay. The singing mainly, the harmony.
Mm-hmm.
the singing's what drew me to it as much as anything. I'll tell you who drew me to it. It's the Osborne Brothers.
There you go.
Because of the harmony. And right. They were members of the Grand Ole Opry. And to me, the Grand Ole Opry was the Osborne Brothers. That was, if you talk about the Osborne Brothers, that was the Grand Ole Opry to me. Back even though it stems from a lot of people. But that was what I liked because it had bluegrass and country.
You know, I'll tell you a side story. Sonny, they were going to quit. The Osborne Brothers were going to quit. They had had Ruby. They had a couple other tunes that they just couldn't find a way to make it through. And Sonny's told me this on the air. There's a lot of interviews with Sonny on this program. He told me they were in a hotel in Pennsylvania, and he called. I forget the name of the guy. I should have looked at this before I talked to you. But he called to whoever down in Nashville. He said, look, if we don't get on the Grand Ole Opry, we're finished. We're not going to play anymore. And he said, well, we got to get on there, and then we got to get admitted to it. And that was, Sonny says, that was the big thing. So you're listening to them, and they're saying that's the thing that kept them and really made them, put them at another level. Back in those days, me and a member was not to degrade it now at all. I'm just saying back in those days, that was a huge deal because people on the radio could hear you on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
So he remembers that well. Oh, good. All right. So the singing, obviously, you can't get better three-part harmonies the way the Osborne Brothers did it. It's my opinion, not yours.
That's what I thought, too.
Yeah. And Sonny never got the credit for singing his part.
No, Sonny was a lot. Of course, Bobby was a lot of the sound because of his singing.
Yeah.
He was such a great singer and did such a great job. Sonny did a lot of the underwork.
Yeah.
Getting songs together, arranging them, and stuff like that. Yeah. And, probably didn't get the credit that was due him.
For the vocal, yeah, for the vocal. And I say in the same way, I'm talking to Paul Brewster, if you just tuned in on Real Bluegrass, I kind of say the same thing as to Bobby's mandolin playing. Mandolin players know what he did, but his voice
he was a great mandolin
player. No question, but I think that his voice was so dominant, they forget right. that he was a great, great instrumentalist and a great mandolin player.
Very true.
And it cracks me up when they did double banjo things on records, Sonny wanted to get in and record one real quick that had double banjos, and Bobby played the other banjo part.
I think they did that with Ruby.
Yeah, I think they did. I think that's it. I think you're right.
Back before the original, the cut that they made with MCA.
I think you're right. I think that's it. Yeah. So he just decided, okay, we can't find the other guy that played with us on the road. Well, I'll just play it. I thought, well, I wish I could do that. But yeah, Bobby.
Yeah, I think. I'm not sure of the name. It's supposed to be Larry Richardson, I think, was the guy.
That sounds pretty close. That sounds pretty close.
But he didn't show up or something.
That's right. So then there you got Bobby.
Yeah, Bobby played it.
One of the greatest mandolin players. I just don't think he gets the credit for that style, for that playing alone, because his voice was so powerful.
Yeah.
But he said, yeah, I'll do the banjo part. And they did it, and that's great.
Right.
So you were raised in it and among it, and you've told us about your first experience. So three albums, 3 years with Knoxville Grass, and then you mm-hmm. played a lot of Buddy's Barbecue, amazing wow. lineup. So what got you back into, let's say, what changed your direction after that stint? What band did you play with?
Well, I was with Knoxville Grass, and my uncle started a thing called Red Gate Bluegrass Festival up in Maynardville, Tennessee, and with Lynn Norman, the guy that I was playing with in Knoxville Grass at the time.
Okay.
And they built the stage and everything. And that was about 1977, I guess, somewhere right in that area. But and that's when everybody was, you know, that was when bluegrass was getting really big. Of course, it started with 19, you know, a lot earlier than that in North
yeah.
Carolina.
Yeah.
But anyway, they built that, and there were a lot of people doing different bluegrass festivals. But they opened that bluegrass festival called Red Gate Bluegrass Festival. Really good bluegrass festival. Got a lot of people involved in it. And Sonny got Sonny and Bobby to come up and play at it. And they heard, you know, Sonny heard me playing with Dawson Grass. And I went to him. He didn't come to me first.
Mm.
I went to Sonny. I said, man, if you all ever need somebody, I would really like to, you know, try out with you. And then just left it at that, you know, and gave you my number and everything like that. And it came to fruition, and I had to go to Nashville and try out at Sonny's house with Bobby.
and we did a couple songs, and we were doing Pathway of Teardrops.
Mm.
And then we stopped right in the middle of it, and next thing I know, Bobby was getting his hat and his mantle and walking out the door. And I just looked at Sonny. I said, "Is everything okay?" He said, "You're in." I said, "Okay, that's the way you think." Be on the bus at midnight. Anyway, that's kind of the way it went.
That's
it
funny.
Maybe a little different, but that's basically what happened.
That's a great story.
And,
go ahead.
I started right there with them, and worked about off a little bit off and on for about 10 years.
What an experience! And you had experience, and you grew up with it, and you got to play with it. But being on the road with the Osmond Brothers, that had to be. I mean, this had to be such a learning experience.
Oh, that was the learning curve for me, because I didn't sing loud locally here with the guys that I was singing with. We singing loud, you just try to sing. But when I got with Bobby and Sonny, if you didn't sing out, you didn't get heard. So you had to learn to sing loud or out. You know, that was their thing.
Yeah.
And the louder you sing, the better the blend is. Generally, that's what I found out. But yeah, it was a huge learning curve for me.
And their whole thing was, and again, I'm so happy to be finally talking to Paul Brewster here on Real Bluegrass. Their whole thing was the blending of the vocals. The blend of the vocals was all they ever wanted to get. They wanted the vocals to be a similar nature. They didn't want a sharp edge. They wanted everything to blend in well, and I can see now why they wanted you to be part of that.
Well, it was the thing that changed it was, it was Bobby, basically, the high lead. That was a new thing.
That
kind of was their thing. It used to be just a lead and tenor and a baritone. But Bobby changed it up. They probably heard that story, but I don't know exactly what it is. But that's where it came from, Bobby singing high lead and two parts underneath. And that became a different. It's a different sound.
Yeah.
But that's what they were known for. And Bobby did all the lead singing, and stayed at a high lead, and they just sang two parts under him on the chorus, you know. So that was that's just part of it. But that's and they weren't maybe the original dude. I think Ralph Stanley might have done that too. Ralph and Carter did that a little bit, but I'm not familiar that as much as I am, of course, with Bobby Sonny.
Mm-hmm.
But that's Bobby and them started. That's the way they started tuning in their songs, was letting Bobby sing high lead.
Sonny once said, you know, they would take a new song, and you may have been part of this, Paul. They would take a new song into the studio, and back in those days, and I've talked to people about this before, you didn't waste a lot of time in the studio because it was money.
Oh yeah, no, you didn't do that,
and you didn't do things on a computer. Nothing wrong with that today at all. I'm just saying. You toured, and then you went in and nailed it and got back on the road because you didn't have a lot of time and money. But
well, yeah. Well, I can't. You know, back when my dad and my uncle were playing together, they would record 10 songs in a day.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody did that back in the day, you know.
Sonny mentioned once that, not to me, but to everybody, he's heard this story, that when they brought in a new song to the band, and Sonny might like it or somebody else, or maybe you liked it, and they would say, "Bobby, what key do you want to play?" And Bobby says, "I don't care." He said, it didn't matter. Bobby would sing any key. Whatever key you wanted, he could sing every key. So that whatever you wanted to play it in, that's what he would sing it in.
Well, I'm not 100% sure about that answer, but because Bobby, they would do it wherever Bobby was comfortable at it. I'll put it that way.
Okay. Okay.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I don't know. I never heard that story before, but you know, Sonny would pick a lot of the songs, and of course Bobby would write a few, and with Pete Goble, and pick songs on his own, and Sonny would do it. But Sonny was probably in charge of picking a lot of songs, and of course playing them for Bobby if he liked them. But he was in charge of a lot more than people realize.
Well, I think
the
arrangements, I think, even on Rocky Top, you know, it was presented to them much slower.
It was.
And Sonny heard it and thought, we can speed that up, and they're going to put it on the B side.
That's right.
And it wound up being this monster song for them. Good thing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So almost 10 years. You put out a lot of, you must have been on a lot of records with the Osmonds. Certainly did a lot of shows with them.
Yeah, I recorded a lot of records with them. Sure did.
And that was a strong part of their, were you in the band with Ronnie Reno?
No, that was, Ronnie was before me.
Okay.
He left them and went with Merle Haggard.
Merle Haggard, that's right.
1973.
That's right.
I think
that sounds right to me. And then Merle, with Ronnie's connection, that's how Sonny and Bobby got to open for Merle Haggard for.
Yes.
Which was an interesting story too. So.
Oh.
So after the Osmond Brothers, then you're still a young pup at that point, and.
Well, at the time I was a little bit younger. Yeah. A lot younger than I am now, for sure.
Yeah. Well, you know, I didn't know till you told me you're younger than me. And I don't consider myself a young pup now at all. But when you mentioned your birth date. All these things just kind of like, well, wait a minute, I'm 55 and you're 56. I get it, the date of birth. So after the Osmond Brothers, I'm sure you had lots of work available to you. And I know
Go ahead.
I'm sure you had lots of work opportunities, and I know for a fact that you played with Ricky Skaggs for a while.
Yeah, I left Bobby and Sonny in 89, is a little bit after Keith had passed away.
Okay.
And I kind of got burnt out with music at that time. And they weren't hiring at that particular time a lot of artists at that time. And I just got kind of burnt out by hearing about Keith. Keith was a friend. And I just hated to hear it. I didn't know Keith all that well, but I knew him from his bluegrass days with J.D. Crow.
Yeah.
Stuff, and of course Ricky grew up with him, and I knew him in that direction. Then he had come back. He moved to Nashville and got started a career. And I heard that of his passing, and that kind of flipped me, you know, a little bit. And anyway, I got out of the business, moved to Florida, and got in the golf business down there, and was going to become a golf professional. And I could get it, you know. And Sonny kept telling everybody I was going to play on tour, and I wasn't good enough to play on tour. I wasn't that good.
So your goal, go ahead.
I was a pretty good golfer, but I wasn't as good as those guys.
So your goal was to become a teaching pro?
Golf professional.
Yeah, okay, okay.
You know, golf shop and so forth.
Yeah,
so on,
sure.
Or whatever it led to, acceptable golf. But I got pretty good there for a little while. And moved to Florida for about a year and a half. And we had I had a son down there. We moved back to Knoxville. And stayed in Knoxville and had a few jobs here. And Ricky called me about 1995 and moved back to Nashville. I said, well, I'll try to give it another try. And we moved back to Nashville in 1995. And I've been there ever since. And I've been with Ricky. I think I left in 2020 when COVID hit.
Mm-hmm.
25, almost 26 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Those are two busy touring bands. And you go from the Osmond Brothers, okay, you take a break, but you go from the Osmond Brothers, who played a lot and traveled a lot, then you go to Ricky. That's a lot of touring and a lot of playing on the road.
Yeah, we did a lot, for sure. We played a lot of dates.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of bluegrass festivals with Sonny and Bobby. And Ricky, we played bluegrass festivals for Ricky. We were still doing country music when I went with Ricky. And we didn't really start doing bluegrass. We did some bluegrass songs on the shows, and they were going over so good. Of course, Bill Monroe passed away in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
And his dad passed away the same year. And he promised his dad, of course, his dad loved bluegrass music. And Ricky loved bluegrass. So he promised Bill that bluegrass would go on with him. And, you know, just to appease Mr. Monroe. And Ricky was thinking of his dad, too. So he wanted to do bluegrass again. So we had the bluegrass really tied in with the country music band, some of the guys that played bluegrass before. So we started bluegrass. And Ricky started playing bluegrass again. We kept the country music stuff too, the hit songs that he did with country music, and, you know, and applied up the bluegrass instruments. And still played country music, you know, at the Grand Ole Opry and stuff like that periodically. But basically, it was bluegrass. That's kind of what Ricky wanted. That's what he felt like he was supposed to do. So we started that and did a lot of records with Ricky doing bluegrass. And it turned out real well. That's what he's doing now.
Hey, Paul, let me ask you this. And again, I remind the listener, we're talking to Paul Brewster. We're going to talk about Forever Young, which is an amazing record. Okay. And we heard that before we began discussing. I want you to talk about it a little bit. But let me ask you this. My mind goes back to early 90s, a show that Ricky came back, and he called it Ricky's Pickin' Party. And he came out with Kentucky Thunder, the big band, the big country band. And he had five or six great – it was like a five-hour show because J.D. Crowe reunited for that because okay. Jerry Douglas and Alison Krauss, who was a child, was there with her band, Union Station, and Alison Brown was a banjo player. Shows you how far that goes back. So Ricky did those a couple times. I saw both of them here in the Cincinnati area. So
that might have been before I went with it.
Was it? He comes out with the first one. He comes out with the full band, you know, with Kentucky Thunder, and then it cuts down to the bluegrass band. And he says, you know, "I'm going back to doing bluegrass music to tell you what I'm doing." And then the big band part of it left, and then he did nothing but bluegrass after that. And then
it may have been us. It may have been that had to have been right at the turn. Though.
It had to be right at in early '90s.
95?
Yeah.
95.
Yeah, could have been then. And he has Stanley. He has Dr. Ralph. He's got JD, and the first time they reunited everybody on stage was the New South, because Ricky was there and Jerry was there and Tony was there. Tony could still sing a little bit, not much. So then that was a heck of a show. But so you're talking about that same area when Ricky's had that great success with country music, and he did a lot of videos. I remember those. And then he just kind of made that turn to go back to touring with bluegrass, and has done nothing but great music since then.
Right, that's true. Yeah, that started in 96, probably started in 96. Okay. We did, like I said, we did a little bluegrass when we had the country band, too.
Yeah.
And, you know, two or three songs. You know, those songs, a lot of those songs were bluegrass at the beginning anyway, before we turned them to country.
Oh, yeah, Uncle Penn.
And so they turned out we could do them with the country, with the bluegrass band, I mean. And some of the songs we couldn't do because of bluegrass, because of the acoustic instruments. But the hit songs, a lot of the hit songs that he did, we could do that with bluegrass instruments.
Well, he had that big video with Bill dancing on the bus.
Oh, that, yeah.
Yeah.
That was a big song.
Yeah.
Yeah, Uncle Penn.
What Ricky said, I'll never forget this. He came out, he's introducing as to why he's turning this, you know, going back towards bluegrass. He said, you know, he was Ricky Picky. And then he said Ricky Picky was doing fine until Achy Breaky came along.
Oh, right.
That pushed him. Yeah, and he decided that was the monster hit then. And I don't think Ricky was going to follow that pattern of what was becoming country music. So.
That was a little bit before I got with
it. Was it? Okay.
Yeah. All right. About a year or two before I went with it.
Okay.
Pretty hard.
Well, he did it twice. He came back twice with the Pickin' Party. Maybe you were through the second one. The very first one, he said, he told the audience, here's what I'm doing. And he said, you know, Ricky Picky was doing fine until Achy Breaky came on. I just thought it was funny. But so yeah. you played with, I'll tell you what, you picked on some really nice, some of the historic bands, some of the best ever. You've been part of
those. I was very fortunate. God's been really good to me. In that direction is where I started out. Started out with the Pinnacle Boys. Actually, that was my uncle's group called the Pinnacle Boys.
Okay. All right.
They had a pretty good group, twin fiddles and a little bit different sound, and it was great. And I played with them a little while, played a little bass, and played guitar stuff, you know, periodically. But I went with Bud and the Pinnacle Boys just about a year, maybe.
Okay.
And that's when Bobby Sonny called me. So, yeah.
This is all great. I could talk, Paul. I don't want to take too much of your time because I guaranteed you that I wouldn't. Just in order to get into this song that the audience heard at the beginning of this conversation segment, I want you to talk about Forever Young and why all of a sudden it's busting through the charts again. So tell me a little bit about Forever Young.
Well, Daniel kind of long story short, Daniel had asked me if I would do an album with him. And he was working with Marty Rabin, I think, at the time. And
yeah.
He worked with him and Jesse earlier on in his career, but he's played a lot of music
with different
artists. Yeah, Daniel's great. And he asked me if I would sing on his album. I said, yeah, I'd love to. And then maybe a couple years later, he came back and asked me again. I said, yeah, man, you haven't done that yet? And he said, no, I'm trying to do it now. And asked me to sing, wanted me to do a song called Forever Young. And I said, I'm really not that familiar with it. And he said, Rod Stewart. He said, well, I remember he did Maggie May. That's back when I went to high school.
Right, me too.
Maggie May and all this, and some other songs too. Yeah. But I kind of knew Forever Young that much, but I listened more to country music and bluegrass music, you know, before I listened to rock. Of course, you had to hear it when you went to high school because that's all that's on the radio.
That's right.
But anyway, I had heard Forever Young a little bit, but wasn't that familiar with it. And he sent me the copy of it. And I said, if you just change the key, drop it down to about D. Rod Stewart sings high. People don't realize how high he sings. And a lot of the rock and rollers sing high. And Rod Stewart sung that thing in E.
Mm.
And I said, gosh, yeah, I could do it, but it would be better if you could drop it down to that D. And we could try to do it right there. So he did. He had it cut in D and sent me the track. And we went over to Stephen Burwell's in Sevierville. And we cut that song that day. I loved the track. That's what I loved about the song. Was a track with no singing on it yet. I said, gosh, I hope I can pull this off. And went over that day and cut it. And we cut it in about 30 minutes.
Wow.
And cut it. We did about two takes on it, I think, maybe three. But, of course, we did, you know, we sung it again for comps, you know, where you can add a track, a word or two to the main track.
But yeah.
Anyway, it took me about, I probably cut it in 20 to 30 minutes. And then we left. And then he sent me a copy of it after Stephen had mixed it and so forth. But I said, man, that turned out great. And I loved working with Stephen because he had a great mic and a great sound. So, but that's basically how that started. He played that song at his wedding. He's always loved that song. His wife got married with that song.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. That's what he played at his wedding. So he's always loved it and wanted me to sing it. And he said he's always had me in mind to sing it. I said, well, I'll try it, you know. But it worked out real well.
Oh, your vocal just bust through that. And I knew the song from Rod Stewart as well. And but your vocal was so strong and so powerful. And I a lot of it, I know they added in vocals after you. I don't think that Dolly was not in the studio, right?
No, she was right in the middle of doing her rock and roll album.
Oh yeah, that's right, that's right.
And we called Richard Dennison. That's her manager.
Mm-hmm.
Does a lot of stuff for Dolly, but Dolly for several years. Richard's a good friend. We used to work with Ricky, and I called him. I said, I've got a song that I'd love Dolly to listen to, see if she would be interested in singing harmony. I don't know what made me call her.
I was going to ask you how is okay. Go ahead, finish your story.
Well, what I saw, I was watching a documentary on TV of Dolly. Of course, she's on 200 or 300 different things, but this particular night she was doing things about her a movie called Dumplin', and I was watching it, and she was showing different people. She was had come in and sing and stuff like that. I just got to thinking, and I did, after I had laid my track down, I said, this would sound really good if Dolly would sing on this. And I was talking to Daniel. I said, would you know, Dolly would really sound good singing it. And I don't know why I thought that.
Boy, good idea.
It just ran across me. I said, and I knew if she heard it, she would love it. And so I, you know, that kind of got the ball rolling, and we called Richard, and he said we sent him the track. Daniel sent him the track, and I said, well, we may hear about it in a month or two if we're lucky, because he was right in the middle of a rock and roll record doing that. But it was about 4 or 5 days. He said she did it already.
Wow.
I said, really? And he said, yeah. So. They sent it back, and she put it in there just like we wanted
perfect.
To hear it.
It's just perfect.
Yeah, and she did it. I mean, you know, it was amazing. It was the track. And then they had to add the dope row and all the other things, and everything just seemed to work
out. It's a killer. It's a killer cut. You know, and Daniel's a good friend of mine, has been for years and years. And I'm so proud of him having this concept. He's a great guy. He's a great family man. He's all those things. He's a great banjo player. Nice guy. I hear from Daniel every once in a while just because I haven't talked to him in a while. But I think he's ventured out, and he's kind of put in the position of, I don't know that he's the producer. I wouldn't say that on some new stuff, but he's certainly involved in the arrangement and everything else. And this is Daniel's album. This is not the...
Oh, yeah. It's Daniel's album. It's on his new album. It's Heroes and Friends. It's great. I've heard a couple of cuts out of it with the people, but he's not quite done with it.
Yeah.
He's producing it.
Yeah. He was with
Marty Raven.
Yeah, for a while. Merle Monroe, and then I think you know, Daniel's is very much of a home person, and his family's really important. I don't think he wanted to get that. I'm guessing. I shouldn't. But,
no,
you know.
He's back in, you know, because he's raising his kids.
Yeah, he's got two fine boys, so I'm proud of him for doing that. Yeah. So, this is a great sound. I'm telling you, it's number one. And it's going to keep going. I just think when you bust into that first, because I didn't know what to expect on the vocal when I heard it. He sent it to me, and I wasn't quite sure what to expect. And I just like, my gosh, what a great vocal breaking out there with Paul. And then Dolly was perfect. I just think it's almost a perfect recording of a song that's never been done.
It turned out really great. And to be honest with you, it's not a gospel song.
No,
what do you mean?
No, but.
I know God's involved in it because of the way things turned out.
Yeah.
And that's the way I look at it anyway.
Well, you know, the lyrics aren't a gospel song, but they certainly do have that feeling of a positive, uplifting, you know,
it's
forever
a
young.
Uplifting song. It's not a rock and roll song or even country song, but it's its own little song. You know?
Oh, man, congratulations on that coming around. I'm glad Daniel came back and said, hey, you want to do that, and then everything else falls together. Like you said, you called Dolly, and man, it's an absolute screaming song. I love it. I love it so much. I'm so proud of Daniel putting this together and you participating in Dolly. And I hope you had fun doing it.
Oh, it's great. Everything just fell in place and did real well, which, you know, a lot of times don't happen. You try to add things or think a song's going to do something, you know, and try to record it, and for some reason, you just can't get exactly the way you want it to.
Yeah.
But this one, every step we've done in it has always turned out real well. It just kind of got better and better every time. But anyway.
And there's something, Paul, there's something about that where everything kind of falls together for a reason. And I'm not, you know, I'm not trying to read more, but I think sometimes that's meant to be.
That's where God comes in.
Yeah, I think you might be right.
Absolutely.
Paul Brewster, I'm so proud to have you on Unreal Bluegrass after all these years, and I'm glad I had the opportunity and the impetus. A little bit from Daniel said, I kept telling him, this is such a great, and he says, why don't you talk to Paul? I said, well, I never thought about it. So all those things have come together for me, too, on this end, where I get to have Paul Brewster on Unreal Bluegrass.
It's been an honor, brother.
I've enjoyed it so much. You take care of yourself and just keep on playing and singing the good bluegrass.
Same to you, Steve. Thanks. Good luck.
I'll see you. Bye.